Maine's little-known role in the illegal slave trade. As the state of Maine celebrates its bicentennial, we've been looking back at the moments in history that have shaped the state's identity. And some of the darker moments have until only recently come to light, including the role that some prominent businessmen and citizens played in the slave trade, even after it had been outlawed in this country. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, we'll talk with our panel, including historians who have closely studied the stories of these men, about how they reflect the social and economic conditions in Maine and New England at the time. We'll also explore the reasons that this history seems to have been kept quiet, and why some observers believe that the forces of fear and racism and exploitation are still at play today. Maine and the slave trade. Today on Maine Calling, first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Keith Shortall, and this is Maine Calling. In discussions of Maine history, there's seldom any mention of how some of the state's most prominent businessmen were involved in the slave trade. It may be surprising to learn about what researchers have uncovered. We'll talk about that chapter in Maine's past today as part of Maine Calling's coverage of topics relating to the state's bicentennial. Joining me in our Portland studio, Kate McMahon. She's a museum specialist with the Center for the Study of Global Slavery at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And Meadow Dibble, she's director of Atlantic Black Box and a visiting scholar with the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University. As always, we want to hear from you. Were you taught in school that the New England states had very little involvement in slavery? Have you ever heard stories about Maine sea captains enmeshed in the slave trade? Email talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook, or tweet @MaineCalling. You can also give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. Welcome, both of you, to Maine Calling. Kate, I'll start with you. So obviously there was at one point a time in American history when being involved in this trade, of slave trade, was legal. And I'm guessing that Maine shippers, boat owners, boat builders, whatever, were involved at that time.
Yes, absolutely.
And were they openly so? In other words, did they treat it just like any other commodity?
Excuse me. Yes, absolutely. It was part of the merchant network that had been established, particularly in the mid to late 18th century, as the beginning of the Industrial Revolution was really starting to take off. At the same time, there was a worldwide desire for cotton, for sugar, for all of these various commodities that enslaved people were creating in the New World. So Maine vessels, Maine ship captains, Maine shipbuilders all participated in this network as part of their regular trading activities as well as directly with Africa.
So and so how did it work? What was the route that these ships took? I assume they carried goods and traded them in one spot and then moved to another. But was there a pattern?
Well, there was the United States coast between Maine and Boston, especially, as well as southern ports like Baltimore, New Orleans, Mobile. These places had a significant connection to New England's merchant economy. So we needed the raw materials that were being produced by enslaved people brought to New England. Beginning in the 17th century, there was a significant number of New England's elites, like William Pepperell in Kittery, who is one of the founders of that part of Maine, was also Maine's largest slaveholder. He owned somewhere around 20 enslaved people at any one time. And he owned a plantation in Antigua, and he would regularly transport both the raw materials like sugar and molasses to New England to manufacture primarily rum. Rum was huge here in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was one of our biggest exports in the region, particularly in Portland. There were rum riots at one point in the 19th century here. So rum, the production of rum was one of our major exports, and Pepperell and other major landowners in New England utilized these plantations that they owned in the Caribbean in order to really create their own supply line directly from the sugar plantation all the way up here to produce rum and other products like that.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about some of the players in this industry and how they actually got really involved after the slave trade was outlawed. I want to bring in Meadow, though. So what I'm hearing here is the setup that the slave trade was an important part of not just, you know, Maine's economy, but the entire New England economy at the time.
Yes, it absolutely was. And the great paradox, Keith, is that it's very difficult for us to put our fingers on the evidence. In other words, we do not have a tremendous amount of smoking guns just lying about. Researching this subject is difficult for a number of reasons. But as Kate can attest, essentially we are struggling with a paradox. We have the fact that this region's economic ascent in the 18th and 19th century was directly tied to this commerce with the West Indies and with Africa. We see this in many forms. The evidence is, again, something that Kate can point to explicitly. But at the same time, this is what we might call circumstantial evidence. We didn't have a tremendous amount of New England captains being convicted of slave trading, for example. And so we have to come at this almost in an oblique way. Researching this topic requires, I call it triangulation. We need to approach it creatively. And so that is one of the things that we're doing with Atlantic Black Box, is to help define and popularize modes of researching this, because we really want to offer this as a community-wide research project and get the public involved, from senior citizens who are very invested in genealogy to seniors in high school who are interested in project-based learning. Everyone can participate in unearthing this history that has been hidden. And here's the paradox. It has been hidden, but in plain sight.
Explain Atlantic Black Box, because it's not a typical organization. As I was looking into it, it does a few things, but if you would explain kind of what it is.
Certainly. Atlantic Black Box is an educational consultancy and media production company, but it's a nonprofit that we are building a number of scholars and community leaders to extend this invitation to the public. So we've all heard of citizen scientists, right? So these wonderful people who go out bird watching and then report on what they have found. They report it back to the scientists, and scientists are able to use that data to make conclusions about trends, massive trends, or those who are out on the ocean and collecting plastics are able to report back to the scientists, and so that we get a broad sense of phenomena that are just too big for the scientists to measure without that public assistance. Essentially, what we're proposing with Atlantic Black Box is a very similar model, but we're looking for citizen historians. So we're crowdsourcing this history, and with the help of scholars and archivists, research librarians, and such, we are going to help the public to do this research responsibly. And then we're going to do this in an open source fashion with total transparency so that everyone can access the data. Here is where the concept of the black box comes in, right? Mm. So if we imagine the black box on an aircraft is what we look to after a crash to understand what caused the crash, the notion here being that we are, if not experiencing a crash, we are in free fall at the moment as a society, and that we would be much better equipped to understand our where we're at in terms of racism and oppression in our society today if we better understood New England's role in the slave trade and the business of slavery.
Kate, in your research, you discovered that it was not easy to find out about these events, and that there was actually, I guess, resistance to, in some cases, in local historical societies. What is this? Is it people not being comfortable with acknowledging dark spots in history, or what's your take?
I think that there, you know, part of it is that we have really since Maine became vacation land, which started to happen in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, we began to craft this narrative of a white New England, one where, you know, we have both visibly, we have this picture when we think of New England with a white congregational church surrounded by white buildings. That extends as well to the way that we approach history. We have valorized our maritime traditions here. We love our coastal New England towns with our captains' houses. And it's much easier to digest this history if you make it make the suffering of other people invisible. And I think that part of this resistance that comes from historical societies, certain people in positions of power in these institutions, is that they are afraid that if they address this history, then maybe people won't want to come here anymore, that maybe our region's history will be less valuable in some way. And I think the opposite is true. I think it shows that if we begin to address these histories, it shows the deep complexity of life. And we all know, I mean, living in the present, how on the one hand someone could put out an ideology that is completely opposite from their actions. And so we can't think of historical people, these captains, these merchants, as all benevolent. We have to really begin to examine what our region's role was in this history in order to better understand how this affected people of color living in the region.
Could you explain more about that resistance that you got? An example of when you were trying to do research?
I'll give an example without naming the historical society. I attempted to contact a historical society in Midcoast asking about a ship captain who I know brought an enslaved person to Warren, who became one of the founders of the African-American community of Peterborough in Warren. And I have not gotten a response. And it's often, I've had some really uncomfortable situations, watched people really squirm out of their seats when I begin to say, this is what I know about this person.
And I promise we'll get to the stories of these real people in a moment. But is this, and I'll ask either of you, is it because we have this historical identity, our self-perception as a region, as having been actively against slavery and heroes in the effort to undo it and delivering people from it? And so what, we just don't want to see this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have crafted this narrative both of this wonderful merchant maritime history, at the same time one that we are at the end of the Civil War, we be the what was coming out of our literature, you know, the Harriet Beecher Stowes, the Lydia Maria Childs, they were continuing to write these histories that forefronted the abolitionism of white people in New England, without complicating that narrative by understanding that while someone could be an abolitionist, they could also be a virulent racist. You could be in the 19th century, you could be anti-slavery while still actively participating in the suppression of people of color. And we have laws that were passed in Maine and Massachusetts that limited marriage between persons of color and white people. We had laws that limited whether or not you could stay in Massachusetts for a certain period of time if you were a person of color. So we have this racism in our region, but we have never addressed it. And I think it's deeply important that we begin to do so.
Well, let's before we go to break, let's talk about a couple of these people. So one is Cyrus Libby. Of Scarborough.
Yes.
Just give me a thumbnail of him.
Sure.
and who he was.
So Libby was the captain of a vessel called the Porpoise, which was built by Joseph Badger in Brunswick. And in 1840, Two, Libby began to take the vessel south. He first stopped in Baltimore.
Sorry to interrupt, but this is after the slave trade was...
So, yes. In 1808, the United States enacted its law abolishing foreign slave trading. There was a series of additional laws that were passed between 1808 and 1820. And it ended with one of the biggest laws was the Act of May 15th, 1820, 2 months after Maine became a state, which these debates were happening in Congress on the same day. I mean, these things were very tied together, whether or not Maine was going to come in as a free soil state and whether or not we were going to take deeper steps to suppress Americans participating in the slave trade. So in May of 1820, this participating in the foreign slave trade became an act of piracy, meaning you could be hanged if you participated. So
the porpoise here and its activities are in 1842. This is well after,
decades after. And in fact, as we get closer to the Civil War, Maine vessels are participating in huge numbers. It grows exponentially between 1820 and 1865, and continues in some ways even after the end of the Civil War. It begins to shift that Mainers are participating in the transportation of indentured people and people who are living in conditions tantamount to slavery. Chinese people from the Pacific world to Latin America and the Caribbean.
All right. Thanks for that context. So Cyrus Libby on the porpoise, and where is he going?
So Cyrus Libby first stops in Baltimore and picks up a load of enslaved people from Baltimore and transports them as part of the domestic American slave trade, which was legal all the way until the Emancipation Proclamation. He began to transport them to New Orleans, and from there he sailed even further south. So he transported about 80 people on behalf of a Baltimore slave trader and sold them to the Deep South, and then continued south and eventually ends up in Rio de Janeiro. And he is consigned by perhaps one of the most powerful slave merchants in all of Brazil at that time, a man named Manuel Pinto da Fonseca, who was a major player. He had a huge amount of political control as well as financial control. And so Libby takes the porpoise to the west coast of Africa twice. He lands in Cape Verde, and then he goes to Angola and transports at least two different journeys worth of enslaved people to Brazil. And then on his third journey in 1845, he is traveling with a porpoise with a group of four other American vessels, and they end up in Mozambique. And in Mozambique, they pick up the total combined about 2,100 slaves between the various vessels that were traveling with them. And on the porpoise, they took just three enslaved people. The porpoise was acting as a pilot ship, which meant because it was smaller than the other vessels and it was really fast, it was thin, it could turn really easily. And so they were looking out for British cruisers and American cruisers, warships that were patrolling the coast of Africa and Brazil, looking for Americans participating in the slave trade.
So there was policing of it at this point.
There was.
Even though very few people got into any real trouble.
Yes, there was beginning in the British began to assign Navy squadron ships in the 1820s to the coast of Africa. They called it the Africa Squadron. But America actually didn't. It's sort of a funny happenstance that this came together under the Webster-Ashburton Treaty in 1842. And that treaty actually established the northern boundary with Maine and Canada. So that was part of the war. There was a standoff between lumbermen in Arista County and Canada over where the boundary was between the United States and Canada. So that law established the boundary. And it also, as part of this treaty, the United States agreed to build vessels specifically to suppress the traffic of slave trading. So this was the first time they built vessels specifically for that purpose.
Okay. We'll come back to this in a moment. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments. The number to join the program is 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Tuesday evening, Governor Janet Mills delivers her State of the State address before a joint convention of the Maine legislature. Maine Public will be there with live coverage on television, radio, and streaming on the internet. We'll carry the governor's speech, analysis afterwards, and the Republican response. Join us for the State of the State Tuesday evening at 7 on Maine Public Radio, television, and at mainepublic.org.
You're listening to Maine Public Radio's regular schedule stream. While on air, we're carrying live NPR coverage of the Senate impeachment trial. That will continue until 4 this afternoon, when All Things Considered will be on the air with the day's full news. Note, we will also offer Governor Mills' State of the State address on air this evening at 7 o'clock. Please note, if you'd like to watch the Senate impeachment trial, Maine Public Television, both the Maine World channels, are offering coverage from the PBS NewsHour. And we have a visual stream on our website, mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, Maine's involvement in the slave trade and the lasting legacy of that era. My guests, Meadow Dibble, director of Atlantic Black Box and a visiting scholar with the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University, and Kate McMahon, museum specialist with the Center for the Study of Global Slavery at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. We invite you to join the conversation. The number 800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. Another prominent name in this period of history is Ebenezer Farwell. Why is he particularly of interest?
Farwell is someone I've recently started researching. He, in 1838, was charged with bringing enslaved Africans to New York City. He actually he had taken a vessel called the Transit to West Africa under the auspices of the American Colonization Society, which was a society formed in 1816 by white politicians predominantly who wanted to send free African Americans back to Africa to the colony of Liberia. Some people went voluntarily, although the closer to the Civil War, it became more common for, as enslaved people were being emancipated, it happened often when a slaveholder would die, they would emancipate the enslaved people that they owned. They were not allowed to stay where they were in a lot of southern states. There were laws on the books that said that they could not stay in the state that they were living in because they were free. So they sent a lot of people forcibly to Liberia. And Farwell was able to get clearance to go to Liberia to bring these free people there. And after he drops off his free people in Liberia, he continues down the coast of Liberia and into the what's now the Ivory Coast and purchases somewhere around 500 enslaved people. And then he brings them back to Cuba and sells them in Cuba. From there, he actually sails directly to Vassalboro, where he brought one enslaved person whose name was Yazzie, and brought him to his father's house. And his father's house, father was also a captain, and his house is actually on the National Register of Historic Places, to live there under the guise that he's going to be an indentured servant. But his movement was not voluntary. Eventually, Farwell is cleared in the courts, and this gets to a point we'll talk more about later, that the American government was not interested in prosecuting Americans that were participating in this trade to the full extent of the law until the Civil War. So Farwell was cleared of the charges, basically that they found they couldn't prove that these people were still enslaved. They said these people were indentured, despite the fact that their movement was forced, despite the fact that their labor was forced. So it's this hypocrisy that these people did not come to the United States of their own free will. And then Farwell turns around. He makes what I have estimated is, in today's dollars, around $20 million off of the buying power of the money that he makes off this one journey, and builds a massive house in Vassalboro. And if anybody has driven down through Vassalboro, it's the huge white house with the big columns, the big Greek Revival house. It's unmistakable because it looks nothing like any of the other buildings in Vassalboro. And that building in 1841, he needs to make more money. So he returns to Africa. And he in a vessel called the Mary Carver, and is when he tries to purchase more enslaved people in Africa, he's actually killed by the local people in Liberia. The vessel is sunk. The rest of the crew are also killed. And then the United States government turns around in 1843, the year after the Webster-Ashburton Treaty that established the Africa Squadron, used the USS Saratoga, which was built in Elliott, to then go to Africa and enact revenge on these people. And they go on basically a 100-mile act of revenge where they bomb the villages, they burn the villages, and they kill several kings, several local leaders and kings, as retribution that these Africans would dare kill an American.
So what was the official history of that chain of events?
And that Farwell,
and was he noted as a traitor and traitor, T-R-A-D-E-R, in all of this, or was that left under the carpet?
The official United States Navy reports state that he was he was killed without provocation, basically. They call it that the indigenous people there did not like the deal he was making with them, but they never mention what he was trading. So I have gone back. I was just in Maine Historical Society a few days ago, and they actually have a journal from one of the sailors on board the vessel, the Saratoga, who went to Africa, and they actually mention he had established what was called a factory there. And a factory was basically a trading post, and they were dotted all over Africa. And that was the place where enslaved people were brought to as a holding facility, while these foreign vessels would come in and then make deals to purchase people and exchange goods. They would trade for weapons, rum, cotton cloth. So there was this circular movement of goods from the United States being taken to Africa to be traded for enslaved people who are then brought to the Caribbean or South America. They pick up sugar or wood or guano and they bring it back to New England, and then this route continues. Farwell has never been noted as a slave trader. Except locally in Vassalboro, there have been whispers. There's things. I was up there. Meadow and I went up in the spring to visit them, and they have an idea, but it's not something that has ever been fully explored by anybody before.
Would you both say, and we've touched on this a little bit, but there still is reluctance and resistance to peel back the layers here and get at the truth of what some of these prominent fixtures had been doing. And yeah. Are you saying that that's still very active?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's very... It's interesting to have these interactions with people where at historical societies and just people that I encounter, especially, white people that I encounter, that do not want to address this history. They do not want to think that our illustrious maritime traditions are deeply rooted in slavery. I mean, really, there is no way to disentangle the system of slavery from Maine's maritime history. Maine vessels were... By the 1850s, were the predominant ships that were entering the illegal slave trade that I found. Maine and Massachusetts have the vast majority of vessels and crews entering the slave trade, while places like New York, which have 10 times our population, have a much smaller number. And so we have to begin to unpack why that is, why we're Maine vessels. We love to talk about our ingenious ship captains, our ingenious ship builders, but there's a reason why these vessels were being chosen. There's a reason why these mariners were being chosen. We can't have one without having the other.
And what have you, either of you, found out about this, what appears to be this reluctance on the part of the judicial system and the political system and all the other institutions to press hard on people who were violating this law?
Well, I think in, you know, it isn't until the American Civil War that Captain Nathaniel Gordon, who was captain of a vessel called the Erie, which was built in Elliott.
And he's from Portland.
He was from Portland. He attempted to transport 897 people in one vessel in the Erie to Cuba and was actually caught. And Lincoln pressed for him to be executed. It was actually President Lincoln that intervened and really pushed the judicial system to make an example of this man, because it was in 1862. It was during this moment, this pivotal moment where American vessels were rampant in Cuba, making millions and millions of dollars while we are fighting a war over American slavery. And that hypocrisy was certainly not lost on people like Lincoln and other people in the judicial system.
So, and you said 897 people. I'm trying to imagine how you fit 900 people on these ships were large, but what were the conditions?
Horrible. A vessel named the Malaga, which was built by the same shipbuilder as the Porpoise, Joseph Badger, that vessel was caught twice in 1846 and in 1847, transporting enslaved people on behalf of Fonseca to Brazil. And when they were captured in 1847 off of Sierra Leone, there were somewhere around 600 people on a relatively small vessel, 200-ton vessel. And by the time that the British Navy had boarded the vessel, around 100 people had suffocated just from a lack of oxygen in the hold. People would die of dysentery, communicable diseases. They were not fed enough to be strong. They were fed enough to just barely sustain life. And even that, not so much. So the conditions were such that the average mortality rate that I have discovered during this period in particular, the later end of the illegal slave trade, is between 30 and 40%. So we're talking that this has massive, massive numbers of people that are dying in as part of this slave trade, that then the funds are coming back to New England and establishing our banks. I mean, Badger was a director of the Pajepscot Bank while this was happening. So his wealth is really comes from this.
After the execution of Nathaniel Gordon, do things change? Does it send a message? Are these ship captains more careful or are getting out of the business? Or what changes, if anything?
So it begins to shift that they begin to transport other people. And what I've discovered is that they're beginning to shift predominantly to the Pacific world. There is still a desperate need for labor in the sugar colonies because the average life expectancy of someone on a sugar plantation is only 7 years during this time period because of malaria, because of just the actual work of this. So they begin to, American main ships especially, begin to participate in what they call the coolie trade, which was transporting indentured Chinese people to Cuba and other places in South and Latin America to work in plantations and to work in conditions that are almost identical to slavery. We just don't call it that. So we shift. It's not illegal anymore. So they begin to find other sources of this labor that just continues this tradition of devastation of people of color.
Hmm. And Meadow, is this we're focusing on Maine, obviously, but what's going on in the rest of New England? Is it the same sort of quiet activity?
It certainly is, Keith. Atlantic Black Box is producing a podcast titled "The Diseased Ship," which focuses on a 200-year-old voyage, so one that took place just as Maine was achieving its independence from Massachusetts. And that details a voyage from Boston to West Africa, where a mysterious cargo was loaded. The ships then sail to the Caribbean and back to Boston, only to cause an outbreak of yellow fever. Now, this is a story. It's a big story. The sort of story you wonder, how could it remain buried for so long? And yet, that is part of the question that we all need to be asking ourselves here, is why is it so difficult to research this history? How have these stories been swept under the rug? And what is it going to require of us in terms of what Cornel West calls critical historical self-examination on a collective level for us to really begin to come to terms with this history, to grapple with it and to reckon with it properly?
I think it's fair to say that we like to think we're good at a lot of things in this country, including history. But is it not sort of unnerving to you as you do research and you find there's all this stuff that not only wasn't known, but was actively sort of kept quiet? It makes you, does it make you wonder about what else is out there?
Yeah, I think Meadow and I talk every day pretty much, and we share resources in it. We are both routinely shocked by what we find. Really seeing that, I can't believe this person, I can't believe this happened. And really seeing just how deeply entrenched it was in the merchant economy of New England. And it's just hiding below the surface. I mean, some of these ships, all I had to do was just scratch, just a little bit, and I was able to find this. And so then it leads me to question, how have we not addressed this before? How has no one found this before? And it reinforces to me that this is an active suppression that's happening, and it continues to happen today.
All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll welcome your questions and comments. The number to join the conversation again, 1-800-399-3566. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 21st, 1887, New Thought writer, teacher, and leader Ernest Shirtleff Holmes was born in Lincoln. He was the founder of a spiritual movement known as Religious Science, part of the greater New Thought movement, whose spiritual philosophy is known as the Science of Mind. He was the author of The Science of Mind and numerous other metaphysical books and the founder of Science of Mind magazine in continuous publication since 1927.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine.
The remote Alaskan fishing village of Tuksuk Bay will be the first town in the nation counted on the U.S. Census.
It's not just for us today, it's for our future, and hoping that the benefits will come.
I'm Elsa Chang, the importance of the census count to Tuksuk Bay and the stories it can't possibly capture this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us this afternoon from 4 to 6:30 on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, the role that Maine played in the slave trade and the lingering effects on racial attitudes today. My guests are Kate McMahon with the National Museum of African American History and Culture and Meadow Dibble with Atlantic Black Box. We had invited State Representative Rachel Talbot Ross to join the program today, but she is under the weather and couldn't make it. The conversation, you can join the conversation, however, the number 1-800-399-3566. That's 1-800-399-3566. I want to get more into this interesting concern about history and what we're gleaning from this, and also some attitudes about race maybe that are still with us today and might require further exploration. But another character that you've explored in your work is named Rufus Sewell mm-hmm. of Freeport. Again, introduce us and why is he interesting in this context?
Rufus Sewell was and remains today to be one of Freeport's most celebrated shipbuilders. The Freeport Historical Society is in one of they have a, one of his houses is part of the Freeport Historical Society. Sewell was noted to have built 100 vessels by his 65th birthday. And there has not been a lot of critical examination of how shipbuilders especially were benefiting directly from the slave trade. And so I came across this vessel called the Rufus Sewell. that was caught in the 1858 in off the coast of Africa with enslaved people on board, and it was actually burned by the British. They kicked the captain and the crew off the vessel, and they burned the vessel on the coast of Africa. I began to look at the other vessels that Soul owned, and I have discovered that this was not his only slave ship, and in fact, not the only way that the Soul family was involved in the slave trade. The Soul vessels were also transporting people as part of the domestic American slave trade, as they were also transporting cotton between New England and the southern states. So they would, just like what Libby did, they would stop in Baltimore, pick up enslaved people, and transport them south as passengers, forced passengers aboard these vessels as they were moving other commodities. So the Souls have, what I've estimated from one of these vessels is they made millions of what the equivalent of millions of dollars off of these journeys. And the overall narrative about Soul is just what an industrious merchant he was. There's no real understanding. There's not been any real deep digging into how did he make his money? How did he go from building relatively small ships in the 1840s to by the 1850s he's building the largest vessel ever built in the United States, which was over 900 tons at the time. How did he get that wealth and the ability to do that? And what I've discovered is that a lot of their wealth came from the transporting of enslaved people, both foreign as well as the domestic slave trade.
So I want to get into maybe your thoughts about why this has sort of been kept quiet, why it has not been uncovered when it's clearly there. How much of it is, do you think, well, it's local pride in our, you know, our local historical figure, and gee, everybody did sort of, you know, sketchy things back then, but look at all the great things they did to our town. How much is it just that, or is there something I think, you know, is this part of a larger problem around culture and racism? Is it part of a larger thread, or is it just a collection of like local pride?
Well, certainly both of those things. I think that the resistance by some people toward me talking about Rufus Soul, for example, is that he's a very celebrated figure. They love him in Freeport. I don't think, as far as I'm concerned, you can still celebrate someone's accomplishments while complicating them as a person, that they did these things because they were taking advantage and of other people. But it definitely gets to this. I actually did an interview on NPR earlier this year for Black History Month. Why is Maine so white? And that's a question that I get a lot. And I think if we don't understand this history, the fact that this is just below the surface, these guys were our political leaders. Rufus Soul was a Jacksonian Democrat, meaning he supported Andrew Jackson. He supported the expansion of slavery. How have we never connected the dots that this person was doing these things? I mean, it's in the newspapers. It's in our historical archives through the State House. So it gets to the fact that these men then made laws. They established these institutions. And that really gets to this structural racism. It's different than what we see in the South with Jim Crow, but it is present. It's just more covert. And if we don't dig this history up, people will never understand and address that.
Yeah. Meadow?
Yeah. I just want to contribute this thought that we take history very personally. I think we need to do some higher level thinking about history and our relationship to it. Often, Kate and I, one of the responses that we encounter is, well, that was a long time ago. We can move on now. You can just let it go. Well, for one, no, because we don't yet know the full extent of what happened here. And we absolutely have yet to process that information really internalize it and understand the implications. But we also just really need to think about our relationship to history. This is not remote history geographically. This is not a, you know, this is not happening somewhere else. This is happening right here under our feet. And it is not remote in terms of time. It is, you know, it was a very short time ago, actually, that all of this was taking place, and the effects continue to reverberate into the present, you know, in countless ways. We have that work to do. So, you know, one of the missions of Atlantic Black Box is to ask people to, yes, recognize that we do take history personally, and to take it even more personally. In other words, to make that personal connection to this history. Like, what was going on with my people here? What were they into? What was their part in this story? Did you have anything?
No, I think that's really resonant, and it gets to just how history shapes our lives. It shapes our existence, and we define history is not something that is just something that comes out of nowhere. History is shaped. History is something that is completely understood through personal perspectives. And historians themselves, we shape history. And so if we don't address this, that the fact that this has shaped the place that we live in, both the built environment, there are buildings in Portland that were built because of funds came back from selling enslaved people. So how do we then begin to understand that we actually live with the legacies of slavery every single day here?
And so as I think we use words like celebrate Maine's 200th anniversary. You know, it's on the one hand, it's a great time to do history because it's front of mind. Oh, it's been 200 years and we can go back and look at history. On the other hand, isn't there a tendency to want to only look at the parade of goodness that over the last 200 years and not do real history? I'm just curious about, do you think now is a good time to be honest about history?
I think now is the most important time to be honest about history. I mean, we live in a world where facts don't matter anymore, where our reality is being shaped. I mean, I think it's what's become evident to me over the last few years is that how actively people can shape what is remembered from the past. So, you know, we can spin these narratives, we can spin these falsehoods that then become part of the historical tradition. Just like the Lost Cause historiography, which argued in the 1920s that the Civil War was not about slavery and about states' rights, that still has huge impacts today in how people understand the Civil War, how they understand the conditions of people after the Civil War. And these things really are especially problematic for people of color. And in Maine, we know that we have this problem of underlying racism. I mean, you only have to look at what the Somali communities, for example, have faced since coming here beginning in the 1990s.
Is this being perpetuated, too, in schools, do you think? In other words, in, you know, the eighth grade history class, are we teaching the same history?
Yeah,
or in colleges? Or is there any movement at all, do you think?
I think there are pockets of movement. I think Portland, from last night's event at the NAACP Martin Luther King Day event, listening to Javier Botana, speaking, the superintendent of Portland City Schools, speaking about how they want to begin to incorporate this kind of stuff into their curriculum. There is movement on it, but predominantly, I grew up in Maine. I went to Maine schools. I was never taught this history. I had to go to Howard University in Washington, D.C., a historically black college, to really dig into this history. And so we really, as a state, need to address the fact that this history exists and it needs to be taught. I mean, it is not required in Maine schools to even teach about slavery, certainly not Maine's relationship to slavery. So that is something that is absolutely deeply important.
Yeah, Meadow.
Well, I stand here today as a witness to everything Kate just said. I am a convert to history. This was not my area of study. I was a literature person, a literary scholar. And I had a very brutal encounter with history in my hometown on Cape Cod. I literally ran into a headstone that caused me to rethink everything I thought I knew about the place I thought I knew best in the world. and made me realize that I actually had to reassess my entire sense of identity when I saw the headstone where it was written, died in Africa, 1795, and asked myself for the very first time in my life, is it possible that Cape Cod's celebrated sea captains were involved in the slave trade? I had been writing a book at the time, and I realized that nothing mattered more than answering that question. It's a question so important that it boggled my mind to think that we had everything there indicating it was a question, it should be a question of ours, and we've never pursued it collectively. We need to ask these questions, all of us, throughout the region, and we need to share our answers because we can enlighten one another.
So only a couple of minutes left, so I want to make sure people who are listening who are interested in finding out more or taking part in the Black Box or whatever, and your work also, where they can go. So Meta, we'll start with you.
Very simple, AtlanticBlackBox.com. Please, if you're interested in genealogy, if you're a history teacher and want to get your students involved, if you are a community member of any sort, please, we would love to have you join this voyage of recovery.
And so you're looking for amateur genealogists, people who are interested in...
That's everyone can contribute to this. And Kate and I are working on developing essentially a guidebook, a manual that will allow, that give people pointers on how to conduct this research.
Okay. About a minute left. Kate, people are interested in your work can do what?
You can go to the National Museum of African American and History and Culture's website, naahc.si.edu. I work for the Center for the Study of Global Slavery. Just a quick pitch. My two projects are the Slavewrecks Project. We look for slave shipwrecks all around the world, and we do a lot of community engagement training, exhibitions, things like that. And I also work on I'm working on an exhibition with Brown University Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice called In Slavery's Wake that will help tell the global story of slavery. And I think Maine really fits into this story.
All right. Kate Meadow, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Kate McMahon, museum specialist with the Center for the Study of Global Slavery at the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and Meadow Dibble, director of Atlantic Black Box and a visiting scholar with the Center for the Study of Slavery and Justice at Brown University. Just a reminder that while Maine Public Radio is airing the impeachment proceedings this week over the radio, you can continue to live stream our regular programming by going to mainepublic.org. Sandra Harris ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling as well as helpful links and resources by visiting mainecalling.org. Today's show will be rebroadcast again tonight at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Keith Shortall. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.